The Democrat most likely to become Texas toast on Super Tuesday? How tomorrow's primary vote sets the stage for a delegate fight close to home. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. ABC News analyst Matthew Dowd joins us to talk about the latest in the race among Democrats trying to topple President Trump. Also, the telecom rollout that's got 57 Texas cities roiled up. We'll hear about their lawsuit. Plus, the author reviving the story of a South Texas equal rights activist often overlooked by historians. All those stories and a whole lot more on the National News Show of Texas. And it all gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 10th day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Monday. Growing up in small-town Texas in the 70s, there was no cable TV, no movie theater in town, and when she went to college, what she really wanted to do was write for the Daily Texan. But she switched majors from journalism to literature and discovered a neat way to make money as a student appearing in TV commercials. What do you know? Last night, she joined Quitman native Sissy Spacek and San Antonio's Joan Crawford to become the third Texan to take home an Oscar for Best Actress. Home for Renee Zellweger is Katy, Texas, in case you hadn't heard. She was honored last night for her leading role in Judy, the story of Judy Garland. She gets to add this new statuette to the one she was awarded for her supporting role in the 2003 film Cold Mountain. A terrific write-up on Ms. Zellweger by Michael Granberry in the Dallas Morning News, well worth reading. Speaking of the Dallas paper, but making a shift to politics now, columnist Gromer Jeffers writes that Texas is critical to the survival of a certain Democrat once considered the front-runner in the race to take on President Trump in November. Jeffers writes, Joe Biden has to up his ground game big time in Texas or he could be toast. Texas toast, you might say. The polls show the former vice president with a lead among Texas Democrats at 35%. The second closest is Bernie Sanders at 18%. But with the first primary vote set for tomorrow up in New Hampshire, Biden looks set to take another hit after a poor showing in Iowa. Political analyst and longtime strategist Matthew Dowd is a long way from his Texas home right now. He's been up in the Granite State, where he's helping to cover the primary contest for ABC News. He joins us now. Mr. Dowd, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here. Always fun to be on.
Well, always great to have you. I saw you Friday night as I was watching the debates up in New Hampshire, and I was thinking, you know, I wonder if anything on that debate stage is going to overshadow or offset what happened in Iowa. Did you hear anything in that debate that sort of seemed to set the stage for what's going to happen on Tuesday in New Hampshire?
Well, I don't think there was one particular moment in the debate. I mean, I think what Iowa did is begin to winnow the field down, begin to some degree. I would say that if there was one thing that might have changed the trajectory a little bit of the race, it was Amy Klobuchar's performance. By most people's standards, she did better than anybody else. She's now gotten a lift since Friday in New Hampshire. I don't think it's not going to be enough for her to win, but it may be enough to have launched her into third place, which would be a pretty big deal headed into this race.
So if you were counseling people on what to think as once the results start coming in from New Hampshire, I would think that you'd be looking toward South Carolina and Nevada as sort of offsetting whatever's happened so far.
Well, I would counsel people, one, obviously we want to know who won, and the polls show right now that Bernie Sanders has an advantage on that. It looks like Pete Buttigieg is going to finish second possibly, but I would say pay attention to who finishes third, because third could determine who is the remaining candidate that's sort of going to fight it out in the time ahead. And I think if that's a woman, whether it's Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren, there's still this grand space left for, I think, a female candidate in this race, because 60% of the voters who are remaining are women voters who are left voting in the primaries. And so I would say watch the order, see who finishes third, and then obviously we go on to Nevada. Bernie Sanders, I think, is slightly favored there. South Carolina, if Joe Biden finishes fourth or fifth in New Hampshire, becomes a completely open race because nobody other than Joe Biden had support among the African-American community. Mm-hmm. So South Carolina becomes completely open, and then we move into Super Tuesday where Texas is on the ballot.
You know, I mentioned Gromer Jeffers' piece on the ground game, and it does seem like almost every candidate has beaten Biden to the punch on that score. I mean, Bloomberg has a pretty mighty force on the ground here in Texas already. You have almost all the candidates. Biden just opened an office in North Texas. Does that matter that much as you see it, or is this about something else, do you think?
Well, if I were ranking things that matter, the first thing that matters is momentum and where you are coming into Super Tuesday, so where you are coming into Texas. There's going to be more delegates by far chosen in just Texas than all of the month of February, when only 150 delegates are chosen. And so I think momentum matters. And then money matters, and then mechanics, which is what I would put men and women, the ground troops, on. It matters in a very close race, but not near as much as momentum and money.
The conventional wisdom is that the battle here in Texas will be fought in the suburbs. Can you think of a candidate who could who can top Biden there right now, or is Biden still, as you see it, the front runner, polls or not?
Biden's no longer the front runner. So I think that Joe Biden is based on what happens tomorrow night. If he finishes fourth or fifth, he's in serious jeopardy of not only not being the front runner, but of basically beginning to figure out where can he stand. He's going to have to win South Carolina in order to be able to have any capacity to win delegates on Super Tuesday. So if he doesn't do that, I would say today the slight front runner, very slight, is Bernie Sanders is the slight front runner today.
Mm-hmm.
But this could be many twists and turns can happen before that Super Tuesday date.
Amen. He is a political analyst for ABC News, longtime political strategist Matthew Dowd. And he hails from Texas, although right now he's up in New Hampshire doing coverage for ABC. Matthew, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard. We appreciate it.
Great to be here. Can't wait to get back to Wimberley.
Many locals remember it as the good old days, and it wasn't that long ago either. In Cotulla, Texas, almost an hour and a half southwest of San Antonio, the traffic used to snake around the block as folks tried to find a place to park or get a spot in line at a local restaurant. The boot shop on Main Street was bustling, the 1,600 or so motel rooms usually full. It was 2013, and a once sleepy little ranch town was ground zero for the oil boom. These days, the streets are rather empty, the shops mostly shuttered. But as Randy Diamond reports for the San Antonio Express News, locals are betting big on a comeback of sorts, and they're not betting on big oil this time, but something else altogether. Randy, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. I'm glad to be talking to you.
Cotulla, Texas, population 4,000. Sounds familiar. How might people have heard of Cotulla, Texas before?
Well, it was at the heart of the oil boom that the fracking revolution that started in 2010. That's how it became famous.
Well, you know, I think a lot of listeners may think, I thought the oil boom was back. I mean, we've been hearing so much about the Permian Basin, but that's in another part of Texas.
Exactly. This is South Texas, and it hit its peak in 2014, and it was the most prolific shale play in the nation, but it's since been down and overshadowed by the Permian.
So tell us what it's like in Cotulla today. I mean, some of the photographs that accompany your piece for the San Antonio Express News are pretty, depressing, I guess, is the best word for it. I mean, a lot of closed down stores.
Yeah, it has a main street two blocks long that looks like the set of a Wild West set on a movie studio. And there was this famous store there, Ben's Westernware, where they had a hat collection of famous Texans. That's closed. A woman from Houston had opened up a boutique there, hoping that would go about a year ago, and now that's out of business. So it's, as you said, a lot of empty storefronts.
You know, it sounds like a lot of small towns across the Lone Star State, to be totally candid with you, as so many people have moved up closer to the cities. But that's, you know, that sort of rural to urban migration's been going on since the 50s, I guess. And the oil boom was a chance for Cotulla to kind of bounce back. So how are the residents there thinking that they might be able to get the good times going once more?
Well, this is a town where LBJ taught school for a year in 1928 to poor Mexican migrant children. And a lot of the buildings date back from the 1850s to the early 1900s. So, I mean, it does have a real authentic feel. So thinking of building a train museum, the train line was crucial to Cotulla's development and create other tourist amenities to bring tourists in.
So a tourism boom is what they're hoping for.
Exactly. And what could possibly help is that despite the fact there's only about 4,000 people, there's 24 motor hotels that were built to accommodate the oil workers. So they actually have 1,500 rooms, and it's right off Interstate 35, about 60 miles from Laredo and 90 miles from San Antonio.
What's the likelihood that Cotulla, Texas could become the next, what, Fredericksburg or something?
Well, that's obviously what the local officials hope, but then at the same time, some of the old-timers, there is Butch County Museum, and the woman who runs that museum, she only had 28 visitors last month, and mostly were people or relatives of people who had lived in Cotulla, so she doesn't think it's going to happen. The city officials are optimistic that it can. They just feel that they have to look beyond oil because it's not a guaranteed revenue forever.
It's a big gamble that the city of Cotulla, Texas is taking. They're hoping to shift from the oil bust to a tourism boom. And Randy Diamond's writing about it for the San Antonio Express News. Randy, we'll link to your piece at texasstandard.org. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Find out what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about the Democratic debate from this weekend, their thoughts, and whether they think it changed the lay of the land ahead of tomorrow night's primary in New Hampshire. On our Facebook page, a thoughtful comment from Dallas Hall. The needle really hasn't moved very much since all this started, he writes. It seems to me that the Democratic Party needs to decide where its ideological home is. Do we represent the center or the left? He goes on to write that my wife and I, both Democrats, disagree on this. I feel the party needs to lurch left to offset the last several years, whereas she thinks we'll lose voters by doing so. We both agree that the eventual nominee will pivot to the center, but we disagree on where the party as a whole should end up. Dallas adds, I find this to be an interesting microcosm of the debate going on right now within the party as a whole. Well, that's just one of the comments we're seeing come through via social media and even email this Monday. I'll be back with more reactions later.
Yeah, we'd love to hear what you think about all this or whatever's making news in your neck of Texas. You know what to do, right? You look up for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice, and then you stand by while Wells Dunbar looks out for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile are building out much of their 5G networks on public property. Texas cities say they're losing out on hundreds of millions of dollars as a result. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports 57 cities across Texas are suing the state to vacate the law that keeps them from getting paid.
Senate Business Commerce Committee will come to order. The clerk will call the roll.
Back in 2017, Texas was considering a bill that would limit the power of cities to control what went on city-owned light poles, as well as their ability to collect rents on the public's rights-of-way. The bill would make it cheaper and easier on telecommunications companies to roll out 5G, the next generation of wireless technology. AT&T's Ryan Tidwell at a 2017 public hearing said they needed it right away.
To keep up with the customers' data demand in our network, wireless consumption has increased over 250,000% in the last decade alone, and it's not slowing down anytime soon.
These networks need exponentially more transmitters or small cell nodes to make 5G work. And so companies wanted to use city poles and rights of way. San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas had already negotiated a rental rate with providers. It ranged from $1,000 to $2,500 per small cell node. But providers then decided not only did they not want to pay $2,500 per node, they didn't want to pay 10% of that. Here's Verizon's Richard Lawson.
We believe that the $250 rate per node is still much higher than necessary to compensate cities for their cost of managing the public right-of-way for these minor incursions.
Robert Miller works for Crown Castle, which builds communications infrastructure. He says what the cities wanted to charge would prohibit small cell networks like 5G.
Those fees may not sound like much, but to give you an idea, this would result in annual license fees of nearly $275,000 for this small network on top of permitting fees that were $40,000. Unfortunately, that makes the network infeasible.
The flip side of that is, so you're saying that the only way you can make money is if the public subsidizes your business plan. That tells me you don't have a viable business plan.
Don Knight is an assistant city attorney in Dallas. Over the objections of cities, the bill passed into law. San Antonio and Austin are the latest cities, joining 55 others in a lawsuit that challenges that law. None of the providers nor the bill's author commented on this story, despite TPR's inquiries. Knight says Dallas estimated it would lose more than $20 million in revenue every year from an estimated 10,000 small cell nodes.
That's not a permitting fee. That's you're using our property that belongs to the public, and we are actually required by the Texas Constitution to get full value for that.
But the money isn't the only thing cities are smarting over. They say they have little control over their rights of way as a result of the rule change.
Exactly. The providers have, I would say, 98% of the power.
Austin Stevenson is in the McAllen City Attorney's Office. He says that aside from some residential restrictions and some design restrictions for historic areas, telecoms can build new poles or attach to city poles pretty much anywhere. But then there's the large power cabinet on the ground getting dropped in people's yards, and that's when people take notice.
And so that's what we've seen, is there have been citizens that call us and say, what is going on? And they're usually irate during the first 30 seconds of the phone call until we can explain the situation, and then they become our ally and advocate.
At the end of the day, the cities still want this technology. They want their residents to be part of this advancement.
Even though we disagree with the law, we're still trying to aid in the deployment of this technology within the city, and we want it to be deployed. We don't want to be left behind.
Cities are scheduled to go to court against the state on the issue February 18th. In San Antonio, I'm Paul Flav.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. City of Austin recently announced it was going after drivers who park in bike lanes. That story got a big response in Houston, with cyclists posting dozens of photos of vehicles parked in bike lanes all over the city. Aside from Instagram posts, is anything being done to keep bike lanes clear in Texas's biggest city? Houston Public Media's Gail DeLauder wanted to find out.
When you drive through Midtown Houston, there's a good chance you'll see a cyclist riding alongside in the bike lane. That cyclist might be Midtown resident Wilson Calvert.
The new bike lane on Gray is a really good use of me getting to the Astros games or the Dynamo games or kind of any way I'm trying to get to downtown.
Calvert tells us he can get to those places a lot quicker than he can in a car. But other times, his smooth trip comes to a grinding halt.
I have been blocked by just about everything you can imagine in the bike lane.
That includes everything from forklifts to police cars.
Probably the oddest thing I've seen was a huge load of bricks. They were implementing a new sidewalk, and so they were using the bike lane as a temporary holding ground. So there was literally a pile of bricks laying in the middle of the bike lane.
Calvert isn't the only one complaining. Cyclists have sent us dozens of photos of vehicles parked in bike lanes all over Houston. We got pictures of contractors parked in the bike lane near Sam Houston Park. In another photo, a giant limo is parked in the bike lane in front of the Four Seasons Hotel. Still another photo shows a City of Houston parade float parked in a bike lane.
It's more just, how do I make that person that's driving the car recognize that that's making it an unsafe condition for me?
Clark Martinson gets a lot of those photos, too. He's executive director of Bike Houston, a nonprofit that advocates for cycling in the city.
We want to make sure that people aren't parking their cars in the bike lanes that were intended to be a part of a system of bikeways.
To try to keep the lanes clear and to educate drivers about the proper use of the bike lanes, Martinson said his group is working on a couple of initiatives with the city's Bicycle Advisory Committee.
One is specific restrictions for city vehicles and contractors that work for the city.
Certainly, before the whole city is restricted, the city itself should consider for their own benefit the people that have contracts with the city are using city public spaces, that they should also be respecting the bike use of those bike lanes.
Another thing they're looking at is something Houston doesn't have right now, and that's an ordinance that specifically bans parking in bike lanes. We talked about that with Maria Ershad. She's Assistant Director of Park Houston, the city agency that oversees on-street parking.
Because we are seeing, you know, a huge growth in the number of the miles of bike lanes that we're installing now, we are looking at what other cities are doing to enforce bike lanes.
Ershad said the city currently has patrols in the bike lanes. They wrote 336 tickets between 2017 and 2019. But because there's no specific bike lane ordinance, they have to write those tickets for parking in a tollway zone.
Which is why we need to get to a point where we're writing actual bike lane violations, because then it's easier and more effective to track those.
As for City of Houston vehicles that park in bike lanes, Ershad said those vehicles can be ticketed, and she also sends reports to city department heads. She also encourages citizens to keep reporting those violations to 311. Even though the illegally parked vehicle could be gone by the time someone gets there. Meanwhile, back in Midtown, cyclist Wilson Calvert says it's really frustrating to have to veer onto the streets because there's a car where it's not supposed to be.
So now we finally have our own spot, our own bike lane, and then that's still treated poorly, and so we can't even utilize it to its fullest extent.
Under the Houston Bike Plan, the city hopes to add hundreds of miles of new on-street bikeways in the years to come. I'm Gail DeLauder.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1 through 4 in their communities. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at RandGroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. San Antonio public health officials say a number of residents who traveled recently to China are now self-quarantined in Bexar County. That's in addition to about 90 people under quarantine at Lackland Air Force Base who may have also been exposed to the new coronavirus in China. Testing kits arrived at local labs Friday, but Jennifer McQuiston with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says results will take time.
They actually have to validate the test in their own laboratory with the personnel who are going to be using it, and that can take a little while.
San Antonio's health department expects results in about 2 weeks, but the CDC will have to verify those tests. No cases of coronavirus have been confirmed in Texas. With less than a month before the March 3rd Republican primaries, retiring Texas Congressman Bill Flores is endorsing businesswoman Renee Swan to succeed him. She's one of 11 Republicans vying for the reliably red 17th congressional district, taking in Waco, College Station, and parts of Austin. Flores announced his support for Swan at a press conference Saturday, saying it's important for his replacement to have lived, worked, and raised their family in the district.
And so because of that, I decided to go ahead and go one more step. And it was obvious to me that based on, I mean, you've seen it in the performance and the forums and the debates, you've seen it in the quality of the campaign outreach that she's had, that she is the person that we need.
Congressman Flores has criticized other GOP candidates in the primary race with looser ties to his district. That includes former Congressman Pete Session, who used to represent a Dallas area district before losing his seat in 2018. A public memorial is scheduled today for former University of Houston baseball player John Altobelli and members of his family. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports they died in the same helicopter crash that killed Kobe Bryant and his daughter last month.
The memorial service is set for 4 this afternoon at Angel Stadium in California, remembering former Orange Coast College baseball coach John Altobelli, his wife Carrie, and his 13-year-old daughter Alyssa. Altobelli is not only a former baseball player for the University of Houston, he also spent time as an assistant coach for the team. Throughout the 2020 season, the UH baseball team is expected to honor Altobelli by wearing a commemorative decal on their helmets. A total of 9 people were killed in the January 26 helicopter crash, including former Los Angeles Lakers basketball player Kobe Bryant and his 13-year-old daughter Gianna. I'm Sasha Kortner in Houston.
And a memorial for the Bryants is set for February 24th at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. She was an important writer, a feminist, an activist, and a leader who helped pave the way toward equal rights in the lower Rio Grande Valley. What she is not is a household name. Long overlooked by historians, a South Texan icon is finally getting her proper due. In a new biography, Cynthia Orozco is the author of Agent of Change. She is also professor of history and humanities at Eastern New Mexico University. Professor Orozco, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the subject of your new biography, Adela Sloss Vento. How is it that she has somehow been missing from so many history books?
Well, it's kind of ironic because in 1977, she actually wrote a book, and you would have thought that once somebody has written a book, their name gets out there a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately, she did not conduct a book tour. She was about 75 years old when she published her book, and 2 newspapers reported the publication of the book. But otherwise, the general public basically did not find out about it. And most academics also were unaware of it. And those who did see her book mostly ignored it, maybe because it was self-published and maybe because she was a woman.
Adela Sloss Vento becomes this lost historical figure, but clearly she wound up on your radar screen. Tell us a little bit about why she was so influential throughout South Texas.
Well, the first thing to know about her is that she graduated from high school in the mid-20s, which was very unusual for any Mexican-American, and especially for women. Shortly after she graduated, she connected to the men who were organizing what was going to become the LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, and she cared about immigrants. She was actually a jail matron, so she worked with prisoners and she worked with poor people. And she started writing about desegregating the schools and desegregating public facilities.
And how did she fight? How did she fight that? I mean, what forms of resistance did her action take?
Well, first of all, she wrote numerous newspaper articles, English and Spanish, against segregated schools. In the 1940s, there were a couple of major bills at the Texas legislature that were trying to make that kind of segregation and racism illegal, but there was not enough support. There weren't any Mexican Americans in office. So it was very difficult because they needed a major change of public opinion that we're really not going to get until the 60s. So she nonetheless protested through her writing. Also, we call her a feminist because she wrote about how Hispanic women were slaves in the home. So she was advocating for them to participate in civic organizations, particularly Ladies LULAC, which were segregated councils for women in LULAC.
She obviously sounds like a unique person who had a distinct vision about rights and freedom. And yet,
yes,
you think about the way that history is taught in Texas, even in the Rio Grande Valley, and I think a lot of people would say that they have never heard the name Adela Sloss Vento. Go ahead.
Oh, you know, that's true, but unfortunately, it's also true that LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, often is barely in Texas history books. J.T. Canales, who is one of the founders of LULAC, and was a state representative, and actually he filed 19 charges against the Texas Rangers. He's hardly in the Texas books. Texas history books need to upgrade and include.
Now, I understand that you early in your career worked closely with and had a personal relationship with Adela?
Yes. Actually, when I was a sophomore at UT Austin, I took my first Chicano history class, and I was very interested in conducting original research. So her son was working at UT Austin, and he introduced me to her. He told me she had just written a book, and so I used her archives way back. But unfortunately, at the time, she only talked about the male leaders and never told me that she, too, was so important to this effort.
We've been talking about Adela Sloss Vento. Cynthia Orozco is author of Agent of Change, Adela Sloss Vento. It's out now. Professor Orozco, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Santiago Jimenez Jr. has done it all. The son of legendary accordion player Don Santiago Jimenez has carried the torch for traditional conjunto for six decades. He's recorded over 700 songs across 100 albums or more, and he's won a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts as well as a National Medal of Arts. And he's played his accordion for crowds in every corner of San Antonio and, for that matter, Texas. And yet, at the age of 75, Santiago Jimenez Jr. is far from done. His latest record is called El Chief, 13 waltzes, rancheras, polkas, the kind of traditional tunes he's played his whole career. And he joins us now from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Santiago, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you, sir. El Chief, the name of the new album. 13 songs on this album. Yeah. And I understand that you recorded the whole thing. Now, tell me if I'm wrong. In 2.5 hours, is that true?
Yes, in 2.5 hours, I did all the recordings. I did the accordion and vocals, and we had the bajo. It's easy for me. The experience of playing for so many years, it's not easy to do it, but the experience makes you, to me, it's gravy, you know.
Where did you get started?
I started playing when I was 15 years old. By the age of 17, I was recording. We did the first album, me and Flaco, the only album we did together. I was 17 and Flaco was 21. Mm. The music was all the time in my house by my father, because not even Flaco and me would be jamming in our house. I would play, just compose, but my father was the main one that was always had music in my house, and I would sit next to him when I was young, and I would go to sleep with his music.
Wow, gosh, that's yes. Wonderful. Just hearing the music, it's so joyous. When you think about where conjunto music is today, I mean, where do you go to hear great conjunto music, and where do you find to play these days?
Well, I really don't. In my age right now, 70, well, I don't feel like 75, man. I think I feel like 30, man.
Yeah, that's great.
The only thing about these musicians, that they don't know the old school music.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking that when I play music of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and playing the old old-style tradition like my dad. That's what I considered me, old-school music, that a lot of conjunto bands, they're not into this kind of category of the old school. Different ways of playing, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're good musicians. I respect, even good or bad, I still respect them because they're musicians.
Do you feel a certain responsibility to keep those older traditional songs going?
Well, it's my responsibility to keep going because I'm the only one that is doing that, honestly. Because mostly all the 90% of the conjunto, they play the new modern style. They like I said, you know, they got their own style. Pero as long as I'm alive, I promise my dad that I'm going to have his music going, and I'm still doing it, you know?
Amen. So do you remember one of your dad's favorite songs?
Yeah, I got one song that, you know, my dad recorded 156 songs. And they're all composed by him. And a lot of hits once. And he recorded with different labels. He did RCA, Mercury, Decca, Imperial, Globe, you name it.
Wow.
You know, late in the 50s. And I got a song that I was 4 years old when my father composed this song. He recorded it in 1948.
What is this song called?
Margarita.
Margarita.
You know, you won't forget that because I think you drink margarita, maybe.
I think there are a few folks who drink margaritas in Texas. Yes, everyone's nodding in here. Yeah.
So I'm going to play. You want to hear it, sir?
Please, absolutely.
Well, this song has a story, okay? I'm going to be a little faster on that. This song, my father was playing in Seguin, Texas, and there was a lady, her name was Margarita, and she was a fan of my father, okay? So my father told her, you know what, I'm going to compose a song for you. And I didn't believe that he did that because after I started playing in Seguin, I met Margarita, and she was telling me, you know, my dad composed her a song, and I didn't believe her, and then other people told me, yeah. And it's just funny because I said, by the way, you're not my mother, are you? And she said, no, I'm not your mother, but I was your father's friend, you know. It was a joke. So I did, and then I recorded it. Margarita, Margarita, no me subas tan arriba que las hojas en el árbol no dura toda la vida. Desde aquí te estoy mirando, sentadita en tu ventana, qué bonitos ojos tiene, lucero de la mañana. Ay, qué lástima, y qué lástima me da de ver a Margarita que llorando está. Ay, qué lástima, y qué lástima me da de ver a Margarita que llorando está.
Woo! That was great. That was fantastic. Santiago Jimenez Jr. is not just an accordion player. He is a bona fide Texas music legend, performing there a song that his father, Santiago Jimenez Sr., wrote years back about Margarita, a real person. You can check out Santiago Jimenez Jr.'s latest album, El Chief, wherever you stream or buy music online. Señor Jimenez, it's been a real honor and pleasure to get a chance to say hello to you. Thank you so much for sharing your talent and your stories with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and God bless everybody.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We cover stories from one end of Texas to the other every day, and yet there may be no subject that generates more social media back and forth than a certain politician who hails from El Paso. I think you know the one. Indeed, passions are so high, feelings are so raw about this certain former congressman, that the Democratic PAC for the Texas House, the political action committee that hopes to turn the House blue, has offered a bit of advice to Democratic candidates. When it comes to questions about Beto O'Rourke, the less said, the better. So reports James Barragan for the Dallas Morning News. James, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hey, David. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. Let's get this straight. The Texas Democrat with perhaps the greatest name recognition and highest profile in all of the Lone Star State is now considered what? An election year liability?
I think that's the question that we were posing, especially after the special election loss in Fort Bend County that Democrats had sort of really riled up as the test case for what November was going to look like when they ended up losing by 16 percentage points and Beto O'Rourke had been their main surrogate. I think that there started to be a question about, is he really that helpful in some of these toss-up districts where some of the moderate Republicans and independent voters who are gun owners and are a little bit maybe more conservative, if he was a liability in those areas? And that's the question that we were posing, that a lot of other news outlets were posing, and what prompted that email from the House Democratic Campaign Committee. I think they were trying to just keep their candidates out of trouble. Of course, they've told us since that it was they wanted to keep their focus on their campaigns. Mm-hmm. But I think it tells you a little something about, you know, just how passionate people are on both sides about Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah. Let's just so that people, in case they missed it, there was a special election in Fort Bend County. And after Beto O'Rourke decided to pull out of the presidential race, he wanted to make a commitment to, as he saw it, to turn the Texas House blue. And he started a new PAC that was designed to sort of get a grassroots thing going. And he actually went out to Fort Bend County and for some considerable amount of time, actually, and showed his face in a lot of corners. And ultimately, the Republican won rather handily, as I recall. Was that because of Beto O'Rourke, or was it because of something else, do you think?
I think that's where the debate is. Beto was the main surrogate for Elis Markowitz in the final days of the campaign, but there also was a presence by Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Michael Bloomberg, who were trying to help out and make the case. It's not just about the presidential race, it's about some of these state house races.
Mm-hmm.
It also was a special election where the turnouts are usually pretty low.
But this was a record turnout, right?
This was a record turnout for a special runoff, right? But it's not going to be the same turnout that there will be in November. So there's a little bit of a debate there about whether high turnouts in November will help Democrats or Republicans.
So what about Beto O'Rourke? Has he weighed in on this? I mean, this must smart just a bit.
Yeah, so I actually I had a conversation with Beto O'Rourke about this, and his position is that he doesn't think he's a liability, not in that race. He had 1,100 volunteers come out from his own campaign mm-hmm. and from his own political committee now. 1,100 volunteers come out to help Elis Markowitz, the candidate in that race. They knocked on 40,000 doors, and they moved the number of Democratic voters in that special runoff election up. from where they were in November. So he thinks that there's a net gain. But I also pose the question to him, maybe not in that district, but what about other districts, mm-hmm. rural areas where there are gun owners, and potentially his comments during the presidential run about having mandatory buybacks would potentially hurt Democrats. And Democrats have drawn a strong line there saying, we do not like that policy. That is not a policy that we would push for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Beto, he was thoughtful in saying that if there is candidates who do not want his presence there because they feel it would be harmful, he's totally fine with staying out of those races and only sending his volunteers. I don't think it's something that Beto had actually thought about before, but he said, that's fine. If that's what we need to do to win the Texas House in November, that's what I'll do. His main focus is on winning that. And so I think he debates some of the arguments, but he's being, I think, thoughtful in how he's moving forward.
It's a really intriguing article that James Barragan has written for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to it over at texasstandard.org. James, great to have you back with us. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, David.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. He's back here in the studio, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. That is, what are Texans talking about?
Well, Oscar talk's still the buzz on mm-hmm. social media after last night's Academy Awards. Parasite, of course, making history as the first non-English language film to win Best Picture. And it's a boon for its distributor, Neon Films, which has some deep Austin ties, some of the principals behind the Alamo Drafthouse involved there with the mm-hmm. distributor. And as you mentioned, David, Texas' own Renee Zellweger won Best Actress for her role in Judy.
That.
Yeah, good on her. Via Facebook, Nicole LeBlanc says, I thought Parasite was just fantastic, and I was thrilled with all its major wins. I'd watch it again just to look for the subtle things I may have missed. Man, I have not seen it yet. I am really dying to. Mm-hmm. And being one of the people who loved Jojo Rabbit, she says, I was pleased to see Taika Waititi win for his screenplay there. Interesting comment here from Janice Hitchcock. She says this about one of the evening's lesser-known winners. The Neighbor's Window was an amazing film in a category full of amazing films. Mm-hmm. It was a short film, she writes, and those short films do not get the recognition they deserve. You know, I've noticed it seems like maybe more theaters are doing like those packages where they show like all of the animated short films that are up nomination or the narrative short films. So good stuff to seek out there if you have the opportunity. I should add that a story from earlier in the show seems to have struck a nerve.
Oh,
that would be the report from Houston on parking in dedicated bicycle lanes, mm-hmm. which of course by no means is restricted only to H-Town.
No.
That spot we heard about talked about its occurrence in Austin and all other major cities as well. This tweet here from Matt McGee, he writes, thanks for getting the ball rolling about this conversation. Texas cities are already dangerous enough for cyclists. When what little dedicated infrastructure we have is blocked, it puts our safety on the line. And meanwhile, on Facebook, Brandon Compton, he says he agrees with these statements, but also urges cyclists to bike responsibly and use that bike lane when available instead of normal lanes. Although I should add that, bicyclists do have a right to use those so-called normal transit lanes as well. Lots of folks just chiming in about lots of things today, David. People speaking about our interview with Conjunto legend Santiago Jimenez Jr., and that was a real fun one.
What a lovely guy.
There, yeah.
What a lovely guy.
Very touching.
And you gotta love the music too.
Yeah.
It's just spectacular stuff. There's no better cure for a headache than that stuff. I'll tell you right now, accordion music from
takes
South
you
Texas.
Away. I know. Mm-hmm. I love it.
That's right. Great stuff. I was thinking about a conversation we've been having. You know, we were talking mm-hmm. about Beto O'Rourke just a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah.
Had a conversation with Matthew Dowd earlier. Interesting piece in the New York Times right now. The question all Democrats need to ask themselves, and here's the question. If your preferred candidate doesn't win the nomination, will you still do everything you can to deny Trump a second term? If you have any Democrats listening, I would love to know what you think about that, Texas. Why don't you tweet us at Texas Standard? You know, you can keep up with the news over at texasstandard.o/R/G, and that is where Wells Dunbar continues to monitor the talk of Texas. He'll be back tomorrow. I'll be back tomorrow. The only thing missing is you. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.